Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about another terrific podcast called Historically Thinking. It's hosted by Al Zambone, a historian, and every week Al talks to historians about how they do their work and about their books and about history in general. This is a wonderful podcast, and it's one of our favorites at the New Books Network, and I really encourage you to subscribe to Historically Thinking. You can go to historicallythinking.org and learn all about it. It's on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe there, and we'd like to give you a little taste of Historically Thinking, so we're going to republish some of Al's terrific episodes, such as the one that follows. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. My guest today is Zhi Lin. He's professor of world Christianity at Duke Divinity School, and his research focuses on Christianity and modern China in the 20th century. Zhi, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as I said, your research does focus on Christianity and China, and the subject of our conversation today is an extraordinary book about an extraordinary woman, although I want to say that the story begins about a very ordinary girl. Mm-hmm. And it's the book is called Blood Letters, The Untold Story of Lin Zhao, a Martyr in Mao's China. Now, I want to delay talking about her importance and even what blood letters mean until later in the conversation. So first of all, when is she born? The basic facts. And who are her parents? Because her parents are tragic and fascinating figures themselves. It's really very poignant.
That's right. She was born in 1932. And her parents, yeah, indeed, her parents had a remarkable background. Her father was at one point a county magistrate.
Yes.
He became one as a result of some efforts on the part of this nationalist government to modernize the bureaucracy, mm-hmm. and say so they open up that this officialdom to open competition, and so her father, who had done well, who studied at a modern institution, sat for the test and came out on top, and so he became a county magistrate. Mm-hmm. But that did not go well, and that in itself is a reflection of the frustrations and the failures of this search for modernity in modern China.
Yes, he was, I think, until the end of his life, he had what could almost be I thought of as a religious, either a prophetic or completely irrealistic hope of Westminster democracy in China. He refused, his failure as a county magistrate was to engage in bribes. either to bribe others or to be bribed, right? And he wanted to be a model of Westminster democracy in a national China.
That's right. He tried to break out of this feudal tradition that he, I think that's what he would consider.
Yes.
And to introduce this Western form of government, a degree of democracy and openness, accountability.
Yes.
And that just did not work.
No. And it's Lin Zhao, she regarded her father with some distance. He dies, as we'll get to, in 1960.
Yes.
He commits suicide, as a matter of fact, after her arrest.
Yes.
Terribly commits suicide with rat poison. But so her letters from prison, her visits are with her mother. But even before that, her father, he was divorced from her mother? He was a little less involved with her life?
That's right. And that, of course, was complicated, what led to the divorce. But one part of that, there has to be enormous stress after the communist takeover.
Yes.
And the Lin Zhao's father, if this former magistrate, had become a political pariah.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that and the exacerbated the problems that he had. So he was separated from Lin Zhao's mother in the 1950s. And that may also have to do with the government's campaign against the former members of the nationalist government, mm-hmm. and the those who consider the bourgeois,
yes.
So from previous regime.
Even though he had been magistrate for like 6 months, he still couldn't hold a job and would not be allowed to hold a job, or he was definitely an enemy of the state.
That's right. He was certainly, there was no place for him
in
the new system.
Now, her mother is even more extraordinary. Her mother was a member of the Communist Party in the 1920s, correct?
That's right. She briefly embraced the communist movement, and then the death of her brother sort of drove home to her the reality of political activism.
And so what? And then she became a sort of entrepreneur, and if I got this right, she was heading a bank in Suzhou by the late 1940s, before the fall of the government.
That's
or she was
right.
on the board of a bank or something?
Yeah, like. she was quite a remarkable sort of modern woman.
Yes.
Produced by all these social changes, in part driven by China's engagement with the West. She was sort of a self-made woman and became also a delegate to the National Congress,
mm-hmm.
in the late 1960s, when Chiang Kai-shek was trying to bring together different forces in society. And maybe
in the late 1930s?
In the late 1940s.
Yeah, 40s.
In a gesture toward democracy.
Yes.
So her mother became what would be our version, the counterpart would be the congresswoman.
Yeah.
And she was a manager of a bus company.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
And just at this time, they send their daughter to school, at the best possible school that they can afford, which is a women's Methodist school.
That's right.
So what is that, for people who are unfamiliar with this West, the extraordinary influence of these Western Christian missions in China at the time, what is a women's Methodist school doing in Suzhou? Is that where?
That's right. That's right. And in fact, that school, its name is was Laura Haygood Memorial School. That was actually not an isolated case. It was part of a much broader phenomenon. And you may look at this as a sort of curious phenomenon. And that phenomenon began in the 1880s, mm-hmm. when Laura Haygood, as the a pioneer Southern Methodist educational missionary, went to China. She was in Shanghai. And then she founded a women's school called McTeer School for Girls. And it just became an elite girls' school.
Mm-hmm.
Out of that school came the the famous Song sisters.
Yes, right.
One who married Sun Yat-sen, the founder of Chinese Republic. The other one married Chiang Kai-shek. Mm-hmm. So you have this phenomenon of many people, many non-Christian families, yes, well-to-do families, sending their girls to get the very best kind of modern education for their girls, Christian school. So after Laura Haygood died in 1900, mm-hmm, the Southern Methodist Church decided to honor her memory, and then they founded this Laura Haygood School in Suzhou, where Lin Zhao eventually became a student.
How many schools like this were there throughout China?
There were quite a few, and many of them were placed, they were located in those so-called treaty port cities, mm-hmm, in the second half of the 19th century and in early 20th century. There were many of those treaty ports, sort of Western enclaves, mm-hmm, inside China, along the coast mostly, but also up the Yangtze River, mm-hmm, where many mission societies were able to found these schools for girls, schools for boys, to provide them with modern Christian education and liberal arts education.
So what was the nature of their education, the education regimen at Laura Haygood and schools like that? What would Lin Zhao have learned when she was a student there?
The most important difference from what education she would have got, mm-hmm, at the traditional Chinese school. Oh, first of all, there was no education for women,
yeah,
in the old system. So the very fact that she had this modern education, formal education for women, it was remarkable sort of development in modern Chinese history. And the one thing she would have noticed is that the students entering the Laura Haygood School earlier than she did would have noticed is that women came to the school without bound feet.
Really? Okay.
Because, for more than 1,000 years, mm-hmm, Chinese women, and ironically, many of them well-to-do upper-class Chinese women had their daughters' feet bound. Mm-hmm. So the having natural feet was part of this modern development. So that's one thing she would have, mm-hmm, found. And the curriculum was modern, as teaches, biology and mm-hmm, chemistry and those things, history, Western literature, culture, mm-hmm, those sort of things. And then also sports, mm-hmm, and music.
Mm-hmm. So she's in this school, which sounds idyllic, and what's going on around her at the time is far from idyllic. So what's... The nationalist regime is crumbling as she's at Laura Haygood.
That's a great question. In fact, many of the girls at this school and at other comparable schools, mm-hmm, they realize what an oasis that they lived in, or sort of an island surrounded, mm-hmm, by this ocean of misery, of suffering, of this breakdown of political order,
yes,
this chaos, this poverty are raging on, but they were very privileged in this school with manicured,
yes,
lawns and rosewood wood piano and furniture,
and all the rest of it.
Yes.
And then two extraordinarily important events occur in her life, seemingly almost simultaneously. She is baptized as a Christian.
That's right.
And then she also converts to communism.
That's right.
Both through the work of teachers, in a way.
That's
so,
right.
Could you describe both of those? And of course, that is the rest of her life is,
yes,
influenced by those things.
Yes. So she went through a double conversion.
Yes.
Within that short period, she was at this Laura Haygood School for the last 2 years in her high school.
And what years would this be, roughly?
She entered Laura Haygood in the fall of 1947, and okay, she graduated just before the communist takeover or the collapse of the nationalist,
okay,
government in 1949. So during those 2 years, she went through this, what you can call it, sort of process of double conversion.
Yes.
First, she was converted to Christianity, and she was baptized. We don't know exactly what were the circumstances and then what led to her conversion and to her baptism. What we do know is that by that time, Membership in the church, religious instruction, chapel attendance were all made optional.
At Laura Hager.
It had been made optional for 2 decades.
Oh, really?
So it was not a result of compulsory, you know, religious indoctrination. Mm-hmm. And in fact, student life was actually it's quite lively. It has all kinds of influences. Students form their book club and they also have their chapel service. And apparently, the communists were also quite busy working among the students.
So she's recruited by a teacher. There are several teachers who are sort of secret communists at large.
That's right. And that was also part of a much broader phenomenon. And I don't think the communists had a hard time doing that. Mm-hmm. Because there were so many progressive youths who looked to communism as the solution to Chinese society, as the way to bring about democracy and justice and an end to oppression and authoritarianism, mm-hmm. and all that. And that, you know, easily inspired many young people. Mm-hmm. And you have many of these young teachers, mm-hmm. going to Laura Haygood and other schools to spread these progressive, what they consider to be progressive, rather radical, in fact, mm-hmm. influence. Mm-hmm.
So she goes off, is this before the fall of nationalism that she goes off as a sort of a cadre in the countryside? Could you, work with the peasants? Is that sort of secretly?
That's just after her actual work. In terms of joining the land reform movement,
yes.
came after the communist takeover. But she did something before the communist
That's
takeover.
Right.
And that is during the last, at least the final months of the nationalist regime, there was a lot of communist infiltration and mm-hmm. work and the underground work in the areas that were still under nationalist control. And what she did, apparently, was that she helped print and distribute communist propaganda leaflets, mm-hmm. in support of the communist campaign. Mm-hmm.
So let's go through her life in the new China over the next sort of 10 years. It works out very neatly to the Great Leap Forward. Mm-hmm. She goes in the land reform movement. Describe that, because I think it's going to be very foreign to peoples. This is an effort to change the peasants, but it's also obviously an effort to change people like Lin, and to change them as well. It's probably perhaps even more a greater priority, at least at that stage.
Yes, what the communist government, the new communist government, launched was the so-called land reform movement to remake the countryside. And of course, part of this was ideological. It was along the line of the communist belief that they can remake the Chinese society, put an end to this ageless tradition of the landlord mm-hmm. Exploiting the landless peasants, mm-hmm. the tenant farmers, and to remake the society, to bring in an egalitarian society. But also it had to do with a more pragmatic goal of this new government to extract mm-hmm. whatever they could from the countryside. After all, the rural population accounted for 90% of the Chinese population, so the government needed to tax mm-hmm. The rural part. And so they sent these land reform, the so-called work teams, mm-hmm. into the countryside to take whatever they could from the landlord and eventually get rid of them, kill them, and redistribute their wealth.
The landlords.
The landlords.
Yeah.
So Lin Zhao was sent to the countryside as part of that. Believing quite naively that she was actually participating in this glorious and in this beautiful effort to remake China, to usher in a new society, which, by the way, she thought was not incompatible with her Christian belief.
Yes, yeah. That was, you stressed that that's many of the people at Laura Haygood and elsewhere, that was their That was their belief at first, and perhaps for some of them, till they died, who can say? So part of that is a recurrent feature of the next 10 years is the self-criticism sessions.
That's right.
Describe what that is.
Well, the communist practice of self-criticism started at the Yan'an rectification, during the Yan'an rectification campaigns in the early 1940s. That was the effort on the part of Mao and the communist leadership to have a kind of almost religious kind of indoctrination mm-hmm. of its cadres to turn them into to inflict enormous guilt mm-hmm. on the communist cadres, on their selfishness, mm-hmm. on their very individuality,
yes,
and to remake them into this cogs of this machine, of the communist machine, to create a new society.
That's a spiritual movement that turns a person into a machine.
and that, by the way, some have argued that that particular technique, of course, it has there was borrowing from the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. but some have argued there was also some borrowing from the missionary mm-hmm. Movement, from the Christian movement, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where there is this repentance.
Yeah.
And so the communist movement was in many ways religious. And so Lin Zhao...
It does sound like a Quaker meeting gone badly wrong, very badly wrong.
But it was powerful.
Yes.
Lin Zhao felt herself coming under its sway. And then she had to come to a point when she felt like she almost had to go through this repentance
yes.
Before the party.
And I know, so you noted several points after a session like this, or after an accusation in a session like this, she gets drunk, not surprisingly, or there's some suicide attempts occur after these, or accusations of rightism and so on. One sees in her experience what millions of people must have experienced.
That's right. And I think there are real... mixed kind of emotional consequences for her. On the one hand, these kind of self-struggle, so-called struggle meeting mm-hmm. and self-criticism can induce a strange kind of a sense of liberation.
Yeah.
Sometimes she will feel relieved when she pour her soul out to the party.
Right. Like attending an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I mean, that's the same sort of, that's the sort of side of it, I guess.
Like, yes, but on the other hand, there were moments she felt terribly depressed.
Yes.
And she got drunk at yes. times. And, I mean, she does not explicitly discuss how that was related mm-hmm. to those struggle sessions, but we can
infer.
Guess.
Yeah, it's a very there seems to be a certain relationship between the two. So, in if I got my dates right, in 1953, she's been doing some journalism or propaganda as well, and she's accepted to Peking University, which I hadn't realized had been a Christian institution earlier, and which is now the flagship institution, remains so, of China. So she's going into a very... she's going to the top of the pyramid. This is interesting because it seems that she's almost been kept to one side. She doesn't seem to rise very far in the party cadres over those 4 years. She's just sort of turning around and around like in an eddy. But now she's at Peking. What was Peking like then? What was its importance then and now?
Yeah, first of all, you're quite right. She was a frustrated revolutionary.
Yes. So what could be worse than that?
yeah. But finally, I think she finally sort of found herself uh-huh. when she was admitted to this very top university in China. I mean, she was already a brilliant student when
yes.
she was at Laura Haygood Memorial School. So she gave up that what appeared to her parents to be an obvious sort of academic career to go to college. Instead, she had abandoned that in favor of revolution. So finally came the point when she realized that she really, her passion was in learning and go to school. And so she applied to and she was admitted to Peking University. Now, Peking University in 1954, it has two different, history. It has two different streams that flow into the Peking University. One part of that was a government university that emerged in 1898 as a part of a late Qing government's reform movement to introduce modern education. In fact, it then had a Westerner, a Presbyterian, W.A.P. Martin, as its president. But that's one stream. That was the mainstream. But by 1954, it had also incorporated some faculty, and then particularly all the facility of a mission university was called the Yanqing University, was founded in 1919. Was a union, a Christian educational enterprise, a union enterprise, because it had participation of many denominations in the enterprise, and it was the premier mission education. And it was that university, Yanqing University, was located on this just beautiful.
It sounds absolutely so beautiful.
Yeah, it was converted from a previous imperial garden.
Yeah.
But then Peking University just took over its campus.
As one does. It's a hostile academic takeover. So she's there and she discovers, or it's discovered, that she has a true talent as a poet, and in classical Chinese poetry. I was thinking about the difficulty of conveying that to a Western audience that can't, this is where it begins. It's hard enough to translate poetry from Italian or Russian to English, let alone from Chinese to English. But I noticed later in the book, you mentioned that she was so good that one of the judges who investigated her case actually admitted to copying down her poetry and saving it for himself.
That's right. They emerged. And I was taken quite by surprise when the judge who presided over the review of the case in the early 1980s admitted me. He was breaking rule by doing that. He was supposed to keep all her file in the office, but he said, "I secretly took home some of her poems and hand copied them," because at the time he had no access to copy machines, so he hand copied them.
They were that good.
Yeah, she quickly emerged in her college years as someone having real talent in classical poetry, and one of her professors really wanted her to transfer from the journalism program to classical Chinese literature program, but for some reason that did not go through. But also there's another factor here. By the time she entered Peking University, she was 22. She began her college as a 22-year-old. She was born in 1932, and that was 1954. So she was more mature, and then she began serving on the editorial board of those student publications, and joined the board of the Poetry Society and all that.
Moving ahead a couple of years, we reached the 100 flowers bloom moment. And what's the original quote from Mao?
Mao said, "Let 100 flowers bloom and let 100 schools contend."
But he didn't actually mean it. And it was a successful attempt to lure people out of self-imposed censorship.
That's right. Mao later said that was his open conspiracy. He wanted to entice those liberal intellectuals out of their lair. He called it a snake's lair, so that they will be drawn out to the open so that Mao can get rid of them.
And it worked eventually after a great deal of understandable hesitation.
That's right. Mao launched the movement, the 100 Flowers Campaign, in 1956. For the first several months, most intellectuals were hesitant. They were suspicious. I guess most of them knew too well about what had happened already back in the 1940s.
Yeah.
Some of the early intellectuals among the communist in the communist movement
itself
had suffered terrible consequences for their criticism of the party. That was from the 1940s. So some of them may have that memory,
mm-hmm.
but eventually all that caution gave way when Mao made it very clear that whatever criticism that you offer of the party will be considered as matters of the internal contradictions among the people, mm-hmm. not the kind of contradictions between us and the enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And Mao guaranteed that there will be no consequence whatsoever for your criticism of the party. And of course, that was
a lie. Not to put too fine a point on it.
That was just before we turned to them and then sent 1.2 million intellectuals.
As he said, this is a quote I wrote down, Qin Shi Huang, who was a legend. Was he an emperor?
He was the first emperor of China.
Yes, that's right. Is nothing. He only buried alive 468 scholars. We buried alive 46,000 scholars.
Yeah. And everybody laughed about that. It was a jocular moment when Mao bragged.
Yeah. And nothing to make a central committee meeting jolly, like a joke like that. So this is all part, and Lin Zhao is drawn into this. She ends up defending some of these some of the liberal thinkers who are putting up posters, and that's the beginning of her suspicion of her being a rightist. Is that correct?
That's right. And what is also remarkable here, and that is she, along with the other liberal students at Peking University. They thought they were really trying to help the party become better. It was really out of their loyalty to the party. And so the realization that they had been tricked into that did not come until later. So even when they were criticizing the party with those big character posters, they were trying to see if that those earnest, loyal criticism can help the party become better and govern more effectively. And the betrayal only dawned upon them later.
So this was a prelude, really, to, in many ways, allow, a steadier on-ramp to the Great Leap Forward and to the remaking of China into an industrial society that would equal England in 15 years. So the 100 Flowers campaign looks sort of like a prelude to the Great Leap Forward. She's at some point in that, all that turmoil, is accused of being a rightist, which is a terrible thing.
Yes.
And she has to be she has to go through reconditioning.
That's right.
In order to be a proper member of society. I think she tries to commit suicide with matchsticks or phosphorus, something terrible.
That's right. Yeah. And that's after she was labeled a rightist.
A rightist, yes.
With its terrible consequences. By that time, and her being denounced as a rightist came relatively late in that movement, the anti-rightist movement, almost like 6 months later.
You had me thinking that she would all, I mean, I know that she's, but what happens in the end, but there was a moment there I thought she might make it through the denunciations.
That's right.
They keep on coming and coming, but she's not in it yet.
Yeah. And what's also remarkable here is that she was not, at the beginning of this 100 Flowers campaign, this effort to criticize the party, she was not among the most radical or outspoken.
Right.
She was cautious.
Yes, and very restrained. She defended other people, but she said nothing herself.
She was quite restrained in her, and cautious and restrained. And she was almost ambivalent. She was torn between her loyalty to the party on mm-hmm. the one hand and her gut feelings about something that was going wrong with the party. And so there was this kind of period of internal struggle that she went through. And then, of course, eventually, by January of 1958,
Yes.
She was named, she was added to that dreaded list, and she became a writer. That's when she attempted suicide, because that was the moment of a complete disillusionment with communism. Mm-hmm.
And it does seem that after that, not surprisingly, something sort of snaps. She is in a romance with another writer, Gangui, is it?
Gansui.
Gansui.
Yes.
And she begins to worship, or take him to worship at the one of the four churches that remains in Beijing.
Yes.
This is quite interesting that this all happens.
So one thing that I realized that after she left Laura Hagel School, she drifted away from the church, and when during all those years when she was pursuing to be readmitted to the party, we know that she lost her party membership after she disobeyed a party directive on the eve of the communist takeover, and she felt terrible about it, and it would just weigh down on her as a huge burden. So all those years, she was trying to work so hard to regain the trust of the party, to regain her membership. So during those years, she did not go to church, because that was completely incompatible with the with this search for party membership. But in 1958, with her disillusionment, she came back openly to the church, and bringing her boyfriend, her fiancé, to the church.
Then her fiancé. He is then sent to internal exile in
1960? That happened in 1958.
Later in 58.
Yes.
And so she starts to write poetry. Can you describe very briefly Seagull, her poem referred to as Seagull? What's it about? What does it tell us about her? What's she trying to convey?
So during that period when she was dating Gansui in 1958 and 59, by the way, Gansui was exiled in 1959.
Okay, exiled in 1959.
During that time, she was working on those two poems, and one of them was Seagull.
Yeah.
And it was a poem to honor her fellow students who had been exiled, who has suffered the consequences of being writers. And possibly a major part of this poem was written before she suffered the consequence of her own her criticism of the party, before she her own punishment.
Yes.
And she felt guilty about having escaped the worst form of punishment. So this Seagull, this poem, was dedicated to those who were heroes in her eyes, who had been banished to this distant island. Mm-hmm. And of course, it ended with this young man, this hero in the poem, throwing himself into the ocean to try to swim toward an island. But that, of course, he never made it. But from where he went down, almost like in a Christ-like descent into death, emerged a seagull flying free. And Seagull, for the Chinese intellectuals in the 1950s, was very much a symbol of freedom.
Hmm. And then even more pointed was A Day in Prometheus's Passion.
Yes.
Which is, of course, about a rebel god who's trying to help humanity, who's imprisoned by an evil tyrant god.
You know. Yes. So in that poem, Prometheus' Day of Passion, Lin Zhao turned this Greek hero into a Chinese freedom fighter, a Chinese intellectual who has stolen the fire of freedom from heaven. And Mao became this villainous Zeus trying to take back the fire.
Yeah, and punish forever.
And punish
whoever would dare do such thing.
Yeah, but then, of course, Prometheus had nothing but contempt and pity for Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, for Mao.
Yes, yes. Are these poems circulated? Are they sort of written, whether the Soviet intellectuals would say written for the drawer? Were these written for the drawer, or do people start to read these, friend? I mean, does word leak out about these poems?
Well, first of all, she wrote that poem in 1958-59, and there was no chance of her publishing these poems. So that that opportunity emerged in 1960, early 1960, when she joined up with a group of exiled writer students from an interior province, Gansu province. Somehow she joined up with them and found out that they were about to start an underground periodical. And then eventually she got her poem, Prometheus, Day of Passion, published in the very inaugural and only issue. And
is that the reason then for her arrest?
And that was the reason for her
arrest. So that's October 24th, 1960?
Yes.
She's arrested. Her father actually happens to be coming by the house, sees it. This, then he commits suicide, I think, shortly after that.
That's right. Her father, who had warned her throughout her teenage years,
yes,
against this illusion of communist, this utopian communist society, I warned her repeatedly, but she never heard him. When he came upon the scene of her arrest and see how her pursuit of communism had ended up, he said, it's all over.
Yeah, there's nothing else that he valued anymore.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And then he took his life a month later.
The worst is yet to come. she is, for the remaining years of her life, she's in a continuous struggle to avoid having her mind and spirit conquered, I think, is what she says, what you bring out very clearly. How does she do that? I mean, in a certain level, we can't possibly know, or it's difficult to imagine how she could do that. But what are some of the ways that she tries to avoid being imprisoned in her mind and her spirit?
Well, she went through also, initially, after her arrest in October of 1960, she went through what I thought was a very human sort of process when she tried to cope with this very sophisticated program of indoctrination that was in place in prison. And because you have to study, you have to undergo this political study, and whose purpose was reform of your mind, the remaking of your mind, to convert and to remake your mind.
Yes.
And she almost succumbed to that.
Yes.
So by the end of 1961, and that's in part of, in connection with some of the changes at the time that were happening to the communist leadership after the disaster of the Great Leap Forward, which led to at least 36 million deaths in Chinese countryside throughout China. The party embarked on some kind of a reform, more pragmatic reform. And that encouraged her toward some sort of regained faith in the party. So she vacillated. She was very, I found that intriguing that she went through the process that she later looked upon as her naivety. She thought the party may be able to reform. So she said, well, if the party can reform, I will support you again. So that's the state that she was in when she was released on parole in the spring, medical parole in the spring of 1962. But of course, the moment she came out, or almost immediately after she came out of prison, she realized that the party has not changed and could not change.
So she returns from that medical parole. Was she suffering from tuberculosis?
Yes, she was suffering from tuberculosis. That was the reason for her medical parole.
And she had suffered that, I think, since the late 40s?
Yes.
Yeah. So she was always, we should imagine, that she's always sickly. This is, which adds further emotion and meaning to her story. I mean, she's a sickly body possessed by a fire.
Yes. Yeah. So you asked earlier, how did she do that?
Yes.
How did she manage to keep her mind independent?
Mm-hmm.
It was not easy. And it went through really a long process. But I think it was a combination of several things. She herself later on reflected upon that. She asked herself this question. Mm-hmm. How was she able to keep her mind clear at the time and to keep her voice, that independent voice, and her mind, her free mind, how was she able to do that when throughout China intellectuals have been silenced? It was not easy, but as she reflected upon that, she thought there was a combination of several things. What she did not mention was her fiery temperament.
Sure. Yeah.
But her, this Chinese tradition, this a venerable tradition of intellectuals, having a sense of moral duty to other people, having almost sharing in this mandate of heaven of the ancient Chinese emperors, or helping an emperor retain that mandate of heaven through virtue.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this sense of responsibility, moral responsibility as a scholar in the Chinese ancient Confucian tradition. And then there's another part was, as she saw it, was that Western liberal influence, which had come into China in the early 20th century in the form of the Chinese Renaissance, Cultural Renaissance, often referred to it as the May 4th movement.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very much steeped in that tradition of the kind of free thinking, independent thinking that grew out of the May 4th movement. But then she mentioned is the Christian humanism.
Mm-hmm.
That she had imbibed in her years at this Methodist mission school.
Yes. The combination, her Christianity, when it's combined with the idea of mandate from heaven has a whole new aspect of what mandate from heaven means and to whom you're responsible and so on.
Yes. And so Christianity gave her, and this is what I found truly remarkable in Lin Zhao, and that is Christianity gave her this moral polar star at a time when Marxist doctrine was the only moral polar star for Chinese intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
But she found a different one.
When does she begin this practice of grand church worship, as she describes it?
Well...
And can you describe that? Because it's... quite extraordinary.
Yeah, because in her prison cell, of course, she had nothing but party propaganda. Everything else was removed,
mm-hmm.
except party propaganda, which came in the form of daily newspaper. Newspapers that were the mouthpiece of the party. And so there's no Bible, no hymn book. But she had this almost photographic memory from the Bible verses and hymns and stories that she had learned in the late 1940s as a high schooler, mm-hmm. at Laura Haygood. And so every Sunday promptly at 9:30 in the morning, she declared that she would begin her grand church service. This one person, grand church service in her cell, using those Bible verses and hymns from her memory. That's what she dug out.
Mm-hmm. It becomes like a mnemonic scaffold on which she can rest herself.
Yes, absolutely. Because that was the her Christian practice, her belief, was what helped her make sense of her political struggle. Otherwise, it's completely futile, mm-hmm. futile and suicidal. But because of her conviction that it was her Christian duty to oppose what she calls this tyranny and slavery of communism,
mm-hmm.
Since it was her Christian duty, she had to keep it up.
So now we finally get to the title of the book, Blood Letters. What are you referring to when you refer to blood letters? It turns out this is actually a venerable tradition amongst Chinese intellectuals engaged in combat with the emperor or with, you know, I mean, but...
Yes, indeed. Blood writing has a long history in China. But for Lin Zhao, it first emerged as a practical necessity.
Yeah. And by blood writing, we mean?
She had to poke her own fingers and use her own blood to do her writing when the writing instruments were taken away from her. Mm-hmm. And that first happened when she was incarcerated at the number one detention house, Shanghai number one detention house. And that's the place where the pre-trial inmates were held. That was the place for interrogation. And number one detention house was particularly for political prisoner.
Yeah.
So she was held there, and she called this a demon's den. It was a place of awful place of torture.
It has a terrible history.
It has a terrible history.
It's right up there with Lubyanka and Buchenwald, or it should be in the memory.
And they use they have ingenious means of torture. They could claim that we don't beat prisoners, but the pain inflicted from different settings of tightness in the handcuffs and different ways of applying handcuffs, it can break your bone. It was an ingenious art almost,
yes,
of inflicting pain. And so, for instance, for a period of 6 months, Lin Zhao was handcuffed nonstop. And often behind her back with two pairs of handcuffs. That's when she took up blood writing, because her pen and everything else was taken away. And she also, along with blood writing, when the particular form of writing she did, mm-hmm, she chose four character rhymes to write her initial blood, to do her initial blood writing.
Can you explain what that is to those of us ignorant?
It's the four character rhymes were the most ancient form of Chinese poetry, dating from the first millennium BCE. But to Lin Zhao, it also served a practical purpose, because you cannot write a lot when you have your hands handcuffed, and
behind you.
And behind you.
Yeah.
And so using her blood as the only ink that was available to her, and she wrote that on her shirt. And also, according to her sister, she had often asked for white sheet. And apparently she tore up the sheet to write, and she did some of her blood writing on those sheets.
So she does this out of necessity. As time goes on, she's also doing it as a kind of a statement.
Yes.
And she does it so often, you say, that her fingers would... She couldn't eventually, they were so scarred or so...
And so numb that she could not squeeze any more blood from her left finger.
Huh.
Yeah. Yes, she did that as a matter of necessity initially, but then later on she also did that as a form of protest.
Yes.
when there were no other forms of protest, effective protest. And indeed, in doing so, she tapped into this long Chinese tradition of blood writing, which had its roots in the ancient Buddhist way of showing religious devotion, mm-hmm, to the Buddha's sutra.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually it sort of bled into the Chinese culture.
So to speak.
And so as a sort of ultimate form to demonstrate one's sincerity.
Yes. Well, and it could rarely have been better used to demonstrate that. We're running way over time. Could you just explain her long letter to People's Daily? That seems to be a sort of the keystone of her prison writing, is the letter to People's Daily. You referred to it many times. It's, first of all, how many characters is it? It's very long, and it's in blood, I take it.
It total about 140,000 characters, Chinese characters.
Which is a long statement.
That's
a
right.
Long letter, at least.
And this particular letter was not done in blood.
She made a
calculated decision not to do this particular letter in blood, because she had another blood writing going on at exactly the same time.
Okay.
So she said, I'm not going to use blood for this letter to the People's Daily, but she was going to use a kind of compromise. She would use ink. By that time, that's 1965.
Mm-hmm.
She had already been sentenced, removed. She had moved from the number one detention house to Tilan Chau prison.
And what's her sentence at this time?
This time, the sentence was 20 years.
Okay.
She was sentenced to 20 years for her role in the publication of this underground journal called Spark of Fire, and for her contributing her poems to that journal. And so that was the second half of 1965, and this was her first chance to sit down and write. Now, pen and paper were returned to her, and so she decided to use ink for this long letter. It was sort of her political statement, manifesto, and against the communist dictatorship.
So you see, it's long, it rambles at times.
That's
it's also very brilliant at points.
Yes.
and beautiful.
Yes.
Like a political statement by a brilliant poet, in other words.
Yes. And it was a very difficult one. And she stamped every page multiple times with a self-made personal seal, bearing her given name, Zhao. Uh-huh. But that was inked in her blood as her statement. And she wrote that, addressed that to the editorial board of the People's Daily. That was the mouthpiece of the Chinese Communist Party, in which she lay out her charge against the tyranny of communist revolution, against Mao's dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And it was also a sort of manifesto about her liberal convictions, her belief in human dignity, in freedom, her belief that the communist dictatorship would eventually give way to democracy, but in which she also outlined the principles under which she would fight for freedom and democracy, and that it's going to be a non-violent struggle. She said that Chinese history has been full of blood, bloodshed.
Enough of that.
Enough of blood. Yeah. There should not be any more blood.
So bloodshed. Powerful that she's saying that while she's stamping the thing in blood.
That's right. And she said she would even recognize occasional sparks of humanity in the very core of evil. Among those who had inflicted enormous pain on her, and at the very core of party leadership, she said, "I could still glimpse occasional spark of humanity in you."
That's right. She could have read Solzhenitsyn, except that they were writing simultaneously in different prisons. She is eventually sent to execution.
Yes.
When and why was it this letter? I'm presuming, of course, that the People's Daily were never their horrified eyes never actually read this letter. But it was stopped by the prison authorities.
That's right. The prison authorities never let her letter get out of beyond the prison walls.
I assume there was acts like this that made her eventually regarded as being unable to be rehabilitated.
That's right. There was no hope whatsoever on the part of the prison authorities that she could be reformed the way the party was envisioning the prison sentence would do. But that also was complicated. There were several factors contributing to that. The radical way of her, this continued opposition, open, declared opposition to communist dictatorship. And that was, again, that was unrivaled. There was no parallel to that throughout the 1960s.
None. We know of no one else like this?
That's right. Really? There were other forms of political dissidents that were actually part of, connected to factionalism within the party. So they will criticize one party leader.
That doesn't. That's just
in favor of
that's
another.
That's
just
rats struggling on a lifeboat.
That's right. And it was, and those dissidents did not transcend communist ideology, the system of communism. Her voice was the only one that break out of that. And so she was doing this. And so the very nature of her this unrelenting struggle against the party, that was one major factor contributing to this change of sentence from 20 years in prison to the death sentence. But then the radicalism that was brought on by the launch of the Cultural Revolution after May of 1966, that also contributed to the eventual death sentence.
And when is she executed?
The earliest time that there was recommendation to change the sentence to a death penalty actually happened in late 1966, as that, but that was then delayed because of huge turmoil within the penal system, the judiciary system in Shanghai, so that her actual execution did not come until April 29, 1968.
And that's it. We'll get to back to that date because that's become important. How in the world, everyone must be, I know everyone asks you this when you give a talk, and I know that listeners must be wondering this, why in the world do we know anything about her? You've just said the prison authorities confiscated all of her writings. They never made it. How is it that you have been able to write a book about her and quote her at length? How is it that her writings survive?
Well, the very fact that her writings survive is really one of the great ironies of this dictatorship that was in place. You know, one consequence of this dictatorship is its rigidity.
Yes.
No prison or public security officials dare to risk a serious political mistake by making any kind of a personal judgment and decision about her damning writings. The most damning kind of evidence against the party's dictatorship, against torture in prison, against all kind of inhumanity. But all those writings were dutifully confiscated from all prisoners. And in Lin Zhao's case, she just handed over. Mm-hmm. She knew that's where it's going to end up. She handed over to the prison guards. But the prison sentence, the system was such that they had to file away every single bit of writing.
And save it. Forever.
And put it into the file as part of this evidence against her counter-revolutionary
action. It just points out, once again, that totalitarian regimes are wonderful for future historians. they save everything.
That's right. I brought up that question when I interviewed this judge, who, of course, revisited her case many years after her execution. And she said, they were all there, but they had to separate all her writings into two separate folders, two files. One was the primary file, mm-hmm. called Zheng Dang, and that would include her interrogations. And, mm-hmm. and that's still locked away.
That's locked away. So we don't know what she was subjected to. We just know that it was...
That's right. Yeah. And according to one journalist who had one glimpse of her interrogation, that was in maybe 1980. Mm-hmm. And he said her retorts, her response were brilliant. But so they were locked away. But then there were other writings that were put into her secondary file. Mm-hmm. And those were the writings that were eventually returned to her family.
Oh, I see how this works in the bureaucratic mind. That was the interrogation records were, of course, not hers. They were the property of the state. And the other was the property of the family, or the sort of her possessions, and therefore must be returned to the family.
And I guess it's also because of their judgment that interrogation, of course, would have to be most directly connected to her revolutionary crimes.
Yes.
Right? And then all her other writings, her letters to her mother, her more personal writings. And I don't know how much time the prison guards spent reading through her writings and how competent they were reading and deciding. Because there were a lot of poems, poetry, and all these literary allusions to ancient Chinese classics and texts and poems.
I presume that when she's writing classical Chinese, she's using characters in different ways and making allusions that they might not be educated enough to pick up on. Is that, would that be right?
I mean, that's right. That's right. And because she often adopted a particular Chinese form of poetry. It was a very, very difficult one. It's called seven character rhymes. Each line would have seven characters. And it's a very strict rhyming pattern, totaling eight lines. And it's very hard to do that. So you have to...
So it's 49... So you only have... Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
You have to pack so much into a seven-character rhyme. It's full of literary allusions and that many gods simply could not understand.
Yeah. So she is retried, in effect, in 1983?
Yes, her case posthumously was brought to the Shanghai High People's Court twice in 1980 and again 1981. And in both cases, the Shanghai High People's Court threw out all the charges and declared her innocent.
And that's when her mother finally receives Lin Zhao's writings.
That's when, then in 1982, when that process was complete, legal process was complete, then the letter, her prison writings were returned to the family. By that time, her mother had died. So her writings were returned to her sister.
So how did her writings begin to become known? Do we have any understanding? I mean, this must be very difficult to chronicle, how her writings began to spread?
It's a combination of different factors, a combination of the devotion on the part of her friends and former classmates to preserve her legacy once they have seen that. But also there were other factors. Her family, one of her surviving relatives called Xu Jianming, her uncle, turned out to be a researcher at a top Chinese research institution, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. And so he got hold of her, of this letter to People's Daily. And then there were these connections of former classmates who learned about his Lin Zhao's fiance, who was sent away to a remote part of China, Xinjiang province, as far as he could be sent, and who only learned of her death in 1979 after he himself came out of exile. And of course, when he heard about Lin Zhao's writing that survived, he wanted to do his part to preserve her legacy. So this is just one example of a combination of efforts on the part of so many people.
Were they actually published in China?
They were not published. No. Of course, there's no chance for these to be published.
I'm sorry to ask a naive question.
But in the 2000s, the first decade of this century, some of her writings, not all, some part of them, particularly this letter to the People's Daily, were carefully... deciphered. I mean, Lin Zhao's handwriting would have to be, the prison writings would have to be, you have to have someone to read her handwriting. I mean, she wrote beautiful calligraphy. Mm-hmm. Still, there were places that you have to tell what the words really were. In any case, once they have sorted through her writings, and they digitized that and posted online, and that's when it became... what I would consider almost a Promethean fire to contemporary Chinese descent.
So where is she now amongst Chinese dissidents? She is now a heroine, the heroine. She's become of tremendous importance amongst Chinese dissidents and all those interested in a different future for China. I think that's safe to say.
That's right. Many leading Chinese dissidents have been among the chief reason for Lin Zhao's influence to be so widespread. One of them, the earliest to see the fire in Lin Zhao's writing was Ding Zhuling, this Tiananmen mother, whose own 17-year-old son had been killed during the Tiananmen massacre. And so Ding Zilin, for many years, had become this symbol of this movement to push for government accountability, reconciliation, truth and reconciliation in China. And so Ding Zilin was one who said she had discovered Lin Zhao. Ding Zilin, by the way, was a former, also an alum of Laura Haygood Memorial School. So it really makes one rethink the legacy of American missionary work in early 20th century China. But then in my book, I quote the late Nobel Peace Prize laureate Liu Xiaobo,
yes,
who, after reading Lin Zhao's prison writings, called her the only voice of freedom left for contemporary China. And I suspect that he said it for at least two main reasons. Mm. One is how her dissent had transcended petty factionalism, yes, that we found in other kind of dissidents. That's not yes, really meaningful. But hers really was a transcendent kind of dissent. And it's her call for this dignity, the recognition of the dignity of human rights and freedom, and her demand on human freedom. That was transcendent. But second part, how she rejected violence.
Yes.
And that was inspiring to him. So Liu Xiaobo later on called, he made his statements, "I have no enemies." He wanted to break out of that, what he called a cycle of violence. No. You end a cycle, in the past of China, Chinese history, there tend to be this cycle of ending violence, replacing with a different form of violence.
Yes.
Or using violence to destroy violence.
Yes. Just as we finish, describe what happened on April 29th, 2018 at her tomb, because her tomb has become, I've seen you say, it's become a place of, as it were, pilgrimage. And just as the dissidents are aware now of who Lin Zhao is, so too is the government, a government who is increasingly micromanaging and apprehensive about just about everything.
Yes, for more than a decade now, her tomb has become a pilgrimage site for democracy and human rights activists from all across China. So the government became aware of that, became alarmed by that as far back as 2008, just ahead of the Beijing Olympics. And so they began to install a surveillance camera over her tomb and to post police, both uniform and plainclothes police, to block the path to her tomb and to turn away democracy activists, those pilgrims. So there's been this annual ritual of police clashing with democracy activists. And then, and so 2008, that's when it began, and that was the 40th anniversary of her execution. Yeah. And so this past April 29th of 2018 was the 50th anniversary of that of her execution. And of course, the police government was quite aware of that. But the police has become very sophisticated in turning away, in bullying, in scaring away democracy activists. They would actually begin, they would track social media. So the moment people started organizing this pilgrimage to Suzhou, way before they even got on the train, police already in action and putting them under house arrest and all that. So they were able to keep most of those pilgrims away. Still, there were some who eventually break through and were able to break through and to make it to Lin Zhao's tomb. Three people, three democracy activists, were able to get to Lin Zhao's tomb just before midnight. That's on April the 28th, just before midnight. They knew that the police would be there. By that time, there were many surveillance cameras already installed, and police had been posted there for more than a month. And so there were democracy activists there, and one of them, called Zhu Chengzhi, with whom I have been in contact. And so there, he and his friends were able to make it there by crawling under an iron gate that the police had installed on the stone path leading up to her tomb on the Lingyan Hills. And a friend captured a moment of that, took a picture of the moment when Zhu Chengshi crawled under this iron fence, bearing a bouquet of flowers in his hand. And this is someone in his 60s, early 60s. He had to make this pilgrimage. And then he made it to her tomb. And within minutes, police arrived, took all the three away, released the two after some interrogation, but then kept Zhu Chengzhi under what they call the designated surveillance, residential surveillance in designated place, which they could do for up to 6 months. That is interrogation at an undisclosed facility for interrogation. Mm-hmm. So he was kept there for 6 months until October the 29th, when finally he was transferred to a regular detention house. So after he disappeared for 6 months, finally we learned about 2 weeks ago that he has now been formally put under what is called a criminal detention, just for bringing his flowers to Lin Dao's tomb.
Well, that will probably not be the last time that Lin Zhao, or her memory, her legacy, creates events, inspires them. My guest today has been Zhi Lin. He's professor of world Christianity at Duke Divinity School, and he's author of a tremendous book, Blood Letters, The Untold Story of Lin Zhao, A Martyr in Mao's China. Li Zhi, thanks so much for talking with me today. It's been fantastic.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
For more historical thinking, go to our Facebook page, where you can comment on today's program and suggest ideas for programs to come. Please subscribe to us on Apple iTunes. And if you like what you've heard, please, please leave a review so that others can find us. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.